I'm sorry.
No, could be him. Today is November 14th, 2009. Is this thing? I'm not sure whether this doesn't seem to be on, Kaiti. Sutta number 6. This is called the Akankeya Sutta, which actually means if one should wish. And for those of you who read Chinese, there's a counterpart of this in the Zhonga Hanjing. It's number 105. Yi Bai Ling Fu. Okay, so the sutta begins again when the Buddha is living in Savatthi, in Jeta's grove. And then in this version, the Buddha begins by addressing the monks and emphasizing the need for the importance of the observance of sila, which is here translated as virtue, but it actually means virtuous conduct. That is conduct that is in accordance with the rules of discipline, and particularly emphasized here is the discipline of the Patimokkha, which is the fundamental code of monastic rules. And so the sutta begins with the Buddha saying, addressing the monks, he says, "Bhikkhus, dwell possessed of virtue," or possessed, it could also be translated, possessed of the precepts, or possessed of virtuous conduct, possessed of the Patimokkha, restrained with the restraint of the Patimokkha, perfect in conduct and resort, and seeing fear, or probably better danger, in the slightest fault, train by undertaking the training precepts. And so here the sort of key word that's being emphasized is patimokkha. And that, as I said, it's the basic code of monastic rules that the Buddha has laid down for both monks and nuns. There are two closely correlated collections of rules, one laid down for monks or bhikkhus, the other laid down for bhikkhunis, the fully ordained Buddhist nuns. And so here the text is first emphasizing the importance of dwelling restrained by the patimokkha, because this is a code of restraint that lays down rules that are intended to restrain types of conduct which are often expressions of defilements, though many of them are also types of conduct which went against the customs of the Indian ascetic communities of the period. They're not very much directly concerned with morality as such, but more with the kind of conduct expected from an ascetic. For example, a bhikkhu, a monk, is not allowed to pluck flowers or to pluck fruits or to cut leaves or branches from a tree. And this is not because the Buddha himself believed that plant life has consciousness. Of course, according to the Buddha, there's no break of the first precept by a lay person or by a novice monk if they pluck flowers, pluck fruits, or cut down trees or plant life. But in the Buddha's time, there was a widespread belief that amongst the common people, that plants have some kind of life faculty. And so when they found that Buddhist monks were sometimes cutting down trees, breaking branches off trees or plants, people complained to the Buddha. And so out of compliance with the prevailing norms of the period, the Buddha laid down this rule for the monastic order. Okay, so the first paragraph of the sutta emphasizes the importance of first observing the restraint of the patimokkha, then being perfect in conduct and resort. Actually, the word that's translated perfect here, maybe it's a little too strong, but it could also be translated as accomplished in conduct and resort. That means that one's conduct, behavior should be appropriate, suitable for a renunciant person. And one should, what's meant by resort here is generally the place where one goes on alms round. That one should go on alms round to suitable places, not staying too long at those places. We came across some of those principles in the Sabbasava Sutta that we studied last time. And then seeing fear or danger in the slightest fault indicates the way sometimes what seem to be slight breaches of the discipline, if left uncontrolled and unchecked, can sort of gradually take root in the mind and then send out branches until one becomes involved in major violations of the precepts. And so one has to be quite diligent and conscientious in observing the training rules or precepts. Okay, so the sutta begins by emphasizing the importance of sila or virtue, because in the Buddha's training, we proceed through three stages of training or discipline. Probably all of you are familiar with the scheme, but I'll put it on the board anyway. Seems I'm restrained not only by the restraint of the patimokkha, but the restraint of this microphone. Like a dog that goes every place with its muzzle, I have to go around with it. Okay, so the Buddhist training is divided into these three primary stages. The training in sila, which is moral discipline, virtuous behavior. Then the training in samadhi, which is usually translated as concentration, that is collecting the mind, learning to focus the mind, to unify the mind. Then this is accomplished through the training in what is called samatha, which means the stilling or quieting of the mind. And then the third stage of training is the training in paññā, which is wisdom, and then that is accomplished through the practice of vipassana, or insight meditation. And so in the refrain, which is going to be repeated in each of the paragraphs of the sutta, we'll find that the entire threefold training is referred to. And so if we go to paragraph 3, we'll just put aside the opening sentence, which expresses the wish, but we can see the threefold training being indicated as the method to achieve each of these aims or wishes that a monk or any practitioner might have. So first, let him fulfill the precepts that indicates sila, the training in virtuous behavior. Let him be devoted to internal serenity of mind. The word that's translated as serenity here is samatha. So that is the practice of stilling, quieting the mind in order to achieve samadhi, deep meditative absorption. And then the text says, let him not neglect meditation. And the word that's translated meditation here is the Pali word jhana. Which often in the text, the word jhana indicates particular stages of meditative accomplishment. These are stages in mature stages in the development of samadhi, concentration, stages in which the mind becomes completely unified, focused, and absorbed in its object. But also it seems to me that sometimes in the text the word jhana is used not in that more specific and technical sense, but rather in a more general sense as meaning the process of meditation, the activity of meditation. So it's the activity of meditation that when fulfilled brings the attainment of the jhanas, the meditative absorptions. And so we could see both devotion to internal serenity of mind and not neglecting meditation to be two expressions that come under the heading of samadhi. Two aspects in, or two prerequisites in developing samadhi, concentration. And then the text says, let him be possessed of insight. And here the Pali word is vipassana. And so that is indicating the training in wisdom. And then interestingly, the text or the passage ends by saying, let him dwell in empty huts. But actually the Pali word, the verb here, I think it's bruheti. It's a little difficult to translate exactly. It means something like to
Maybe to frequent empty huts might be better, except that now we don't often use frequent as a verb in English. It seems a little bit archaic. But it has the sense not simply of dwelling in them, but of often, maybe we could say frequently dwelling in empty huts. And an empty hut is indicated as the suitable place for practicing meditation, whether it be serenity, a samatha, or vipassana, insight. So generally in South and Southeast Asia, in the monastery, there'll be a number of what are called kutis. These are little huts which might just be equipped with a bed, a simple table, a chair. More modern ones will have an attached toilet. And some of them will have even an attached walkway with a canopy above it. So when it's raining or during the middle of the day when the sun is hot, the monk can do the walking meditation without having to worry about either being drenched by rain or sweltering because of the hot sun. The less, shall I say, luxurious meditation kutis don't have the sheltered canopy, but the walkway is out. It could be under trees, and so the trees will provide shelter from the hot sun, but they're not so effective in providing shelter when it's during the monsoon season when the rain comes pouring down. Then one has to stay indoors. Okay, so now this is a repetitive passage that will come at the end of every one of the paragraphs of the sutta. And so based on this framework of sila, samadhi, panya, moral, virtuous behavior, concentration, wisdom, the Buddha is going to show how a monk or any aspirant can fulfill any of his virtuous wishes. And we see here that there'll be, as the Buddha often indicates, a gradual deepening of the types, or a gradual deepening or a gradual elevation of the types of things for which one might wish. Okay, so the first is, if the monk should wish, may I be dear and agreeable to my companions in the holy life, the brahmacharya, the spiritual life, respected and esteemed by them, let him fulfill the three stages of the training indicated here by precepts, serenity, jhana, insight, and frequenting empty huts. So the first, this is a somewhat worldly wish, though of course it's a natural wish which is can be wholesome if it steers one in a wholesome direction. Since when one is living together with other monks, nuns, or practitioners in a monastery or meditation center, one wants to have friendly relations with them based upon mutual appreciation and mutual respect. And so being dedicated to the threefold training, that is the way to inspire both the affection and respect and esteem of others. So the Buddha begins with this, probably in order to show how the observance of the threefold training is necessary as a basis, a foundation for establishing harmony and cooperation and mutual appreciation, mutual admiration amongst his ordained disciples. Sometimes the text contrasts two ways in which the Sangha might be dwelling. The undesirable way, it's said, is that the monks are engaged in arguments, quarrels and disputes, wounding each other with the knives of their mouths. So they use the tongue like a knife or like a sword, speaking angrily and bitterly to others, putting them down, quarreling, disputing. Sometimes it could be over very trivial little points. And then in contrast, we have the harmonious Sangha. And in this Sangha, it's said that the monks are dwelling, blending like milk and water. Like when you take milk, or if you take water, pour it into milk, the water just mixes with the milk. And so you can't distinguish what is milk, what is water. So it's said that the monks are dwelling together, harmonious, with mutual appreciation, blending like milk and water. Okay, so this is the first wish that can be fulfilled through the threefold training. Then we come to the second. Again, this is a little bit worldly. May I be one to obtain robes, alms food, resting place, and medicinal requisites. If he has that kind of wish, let him fulfill the precepts. I'm laughing because yesterday, just as I was settling down to my afternoon nap, the telephone started to ring, and it was a friend of mine, another monk living in the U.S., in Tennessee. He said he has a problem. Some of his supporters asked him if he needs new robes. He said, I need some new robes. If he needs new robes, he said, yes, I need some new robes. But please don't get me bright orange robes. So he called and he told me, so the supporters brought me the package of robes. I opened it, looked inside, and they're bright orange. What am I going to do? And I said, well, one week meet in the middle of Manhattan and discuss the matter. But to me, you have to be wearing your bright orange robes. Then I was thinking to call him and say, hello, this is Nashville Fire Department. The neighbors were telling us they were seeing some bright orange flames coming out the window. Calling just to find out whether there's any fire going on. Anyway, I'll have to call him back this afternoon and tell him maybe I could arrange for him to get on Oprah Winfrey. Only if he wears the bright orange robes. Okay, so if one wishes to obtain things like robes, alms food, resting place, medicinal requisites, then one should fulfill the threefold training. This is said because, you see, within the Buddhist community, there's a principle that the lay community supports the monastic communities, and lay people support the monastic communities with the idea that this is a way of acquiring, we call, punya or merit. And then the merit depends on the virtuous behavior and virtuous way of life of the monastic person. So if, say, the monks are neglecting their practice, not observing the precepts properly, behaving in unscrupulous, objectionable ways, then people become upset with the monastics and they don't want to provide support to them. But when the monastics behave properly, when they show, when one can see that they're diligent and upright, then people want to make offerings to them. Sometimes this can become a little bit problematic. In fact, it's almost like the paradox at the heart of Buddhist social community, because the monasteries sometimes tend to get too many offerings, so that closets can become filled with robes which are often not used, or sometimes people offer things which are not really so necessary for a monk's life. But I guess in the Buddha's day, it was not so easy to make things like robes, and so it was actually special occasions for monks, a need which would often arise in the monastic order to obtain new robes or to obtain a suitable dwelling place. Okay, so this is the kind of wish that a monk could have, and this is, we call this a self-directed wish. The next two are still somewhat mundane wishes, but they have an altruistic dimension. Okay, so in paragraph 5, if the monk should wish, may the services of those whose robes, alms food, resting place, and medicinal requisites that I use bring them great fruit and benefit, let him fulfill the precepts. Okay, so in this case, because of this principle of merit, in order for the practitioner to become a proper field of merit, who will enable the people who make the offerings to acquire the wholesome karma, or to acquire abundant wholesome karma through making the offerings, then he should fulfill the principles of the threefold, he should fulfill the threefold training. Then when people make the offerings, because the monk becomes a more fertile field of merit, then those offerings will redound to their welfare and happiness for a long time. Then paragraph 6 continues this altruistic note or theme. If the monk should wish, when my kinsmen and relatives who have passed away remember me with confidence in their minds, may that bring them great fruit and benefit. Okay, this might seem a little bit strange to a Westerner who's not familiar with these principles of Buddhist thought. The underlying principle here is that when our relatives pass away, according to Buddhism, they don't just vanish into nothingness, but many of them will continue to exist on certain, call these, other vibrational frequencies and other subtle realms of existence. It could be in the deva realms, the realms of the gods, in the realm of the pretas or ghostly realms. And in these realms, the relatives are able to witness what we are doing. They're able to see our actions, even though we might not be able to see them. And in some of these realms, the relatives are not able to do any wholesome karma, to originate any wholesome karma on their own, but they are dependent on the wholesome behavior of their living relatives in order to advance spiritually. So the way this works, sometimes we use the phrase in the popular literature, what is the phrase? Transference of merit. But the merit is not actually transferred from, say, from myself to my departed relatives. But rather, what one does, one performs some wholesome deeds, virtuous deeds, and one makes the wish in one's mind, may this merit be shared by my departed relatives. May they witness my good deeds, and may they rejoice in these deeds, and may, by rejoicing, may they partake in the merit of my deeds. And so by making this mental determination or mental wish for the relatives to know the good deeds that we're doing, they're able to rejoice, at least some of them, those who are in these subtle realms, can rejoice in the good deeds. In their own hearts, they feel glad and happy that their living human relative is doing good deeds and thinking of them with a heart of loving kindness and wishing for their welfare. And then when they're aware of this, they rejoice, and their rejoicing becomes for them a source of merit. So that's how they are able to obtain meritorious karma. And so it's the tradition in the Buddhist countries, say if somebody's relative has passed away, then they will often, they go to the monastery, they'll invite a group of monks to come to their house, and it could be often, in Sri Lanka it would be 3 days after the death, 7 days, 1 month, and then after that 3 months, then after that the annual Memorial Day each year. So they invite the monks to come to their house, they make an offering of food and other requisites like robes, the little deli, things that one uses every day, like toothpaste, toothbrush, soap, a towel, some simple medicines, non-prescription medicines. Sometimes if one needs, has something special that one needs, they could offer bed sheets, pillows, pillowcases, whatever. Then after that, sort of guided by the monks, they do a little ceremony of, it's sort of symbolized by taking water. One has water in a pitcher, a bowl, and the bowl is placed on a plate, and then they pour the water from the pitcher into the bowl till it fills up the bowl and overflows the bowl, flowing out into the plate. And this symbolizes, and while they're doing this, they're reciting some verses, Idam me nyati nam hotu sukitaho hantu nyatayo. May this merit go to my relatives. May my relatives be happy. And then the water overflowing the bowl into the plate symbolizes the merit overflowing from the people who have made the offerings, flowing over to their relatives who have passed away and are now living in some other realm of existence. So whenever we do meritorious deeds, even at the end of the day, especially if you do meditation sitting, at the end of the sitting, then you could just think, just for a few moments, of departed relatives, either specifically, like if it's a departed father, mother, brother, sister, or generally, may any of my departed relatives or friends rejoice in this merit and receive all benefits. And it's quite possible that there are departed relatives, that you have departed relatives who will witness this, rejoice, and that will help them in their new life and their transition back to the human realm. Okay, so that is what is being indicated here in this passage, number 6. Because when one observes the precepts, practices meditation, develops insight, then one acquires the merit, and one offers that merit, or one invites the departed relatives to rejoice in that merit, to think of one with trust, with confidence, with joy, and then that will bring them great benefits. Okay, then the Buddha says, the monk might wish, may I become a conqueror of discontent and delight. Here, discontent means becoming upset, becoming dissatisfied. For example, becoming dissatisfied with having to live maybe in the forest, just in a simple hut, having to go on alms round every day, missing out on the pleasures and the worldly pleasures and enjoyments. So that is discontent. And often when that arises, if it becomes very strong, then it will lead the monastic person to disrobe and return to the worldly life. Then the opposite of this is what's called delight, but this is not the spiritual delight, but this is the tendency of the mind to be seeking delight in what might call worldly enjoyments. So maybe, say, since in the monk's life there's not much entertainment, so the monk might be thinking of what kind of food he's going to get with the meal offering that day or the next day, or if he gets thinking, how can I get beautiful robes, how can I get a nice, instead of having this little bamboo hut out in the forest, how can I get a nice solid cottage with 4 or 5 rooms. Okay, and so to become the conqueror of discontent and delight, one has to follow this threefold training. When one follows the training diligently, then one begins to experience an inner happiness, an inner joy, which stays with one. It becomes a kind of footing, let's say, like an island that gives one a foothold and that will support one amongst the tempestuous currents of worldly desire. And so one doesn't become discontent, thinking that one is missing out on the enjoyments of the worldly life, because now one has this inner pleasure, this inner happiness, which swells up from the mind itself. And because one has access to that inner happiness, the mind doesn't dwell upon the prospect of indulging in worldly delights. And so in this way, one conquers discontent and delight. Okay, see, now we'll be moving away from somewhat mundane desires to more spiritual desires. So first to conquer discontent and delight, then comes the wish, may I become a conqueror of fear and dread, and may fear and dread not conquer me. This is something that can arise in a monk who's living out in the forest. Because when one is living in the forest, it could be far away from others. Even if one is living in a monastery with huts spread out in the forest, one can have fear of wild animals. I guess in India, in the Buddha's time, there was still, the forests were quite thick, so there would be animals like tigers, leopards, bears, hyenas. And then the mind can project all kinds of wild ideas. So sometimes if the wind is blowing and then the branches are rustling against one another, one gets the fear, the tiger is coming to get me. The leopard has come. And then in ancient India, in the Buddha's time, and even in Asia today, there's a widespread belief in ghosts. And I mean, I've known mature, highly educated monks in Sri Lanka who still believe in ghosts, even Westerners. And so when you're living alone or in a very quiet place at night, and then there's this, again, the wind blowing, rustling of leaves, strange sounds. The candle goes out, you have no matches. Then comes the fear that the ghosts or the zombies are going to come and catch me and eat me. And then, of course, the monks will be familiar with the stories from the Pali commentaries, which talk about how these, we call them yakshas, these terrible, ferocious monsters come and they eat up the monks living alone in the forest. Once I was thinking, I'm going to be the subject of the next story. They'll come and they'll find me with my head eaten off, just the body, with everything from the neck down remaining, but the head is gone, or the body is torn open, and the internal organs are all gone, and so one becomes very afraid. Okay, so to conquer this fear, then when one has strong meditation, then even though one might hear animals coming, even though there might really be animals out there, but because one has the strong power of samadhi, one doesn't let fear arise in the mind, but one can keep the mind calm and equanimous under those conditions. And sometimes it's said that those monks who have strong power of samadhi, particularly if they have developed strong metta and karuna, loving kindness and compassion, they can dwell even amidst the wild animals, and the wild animals have just no thoughts of harming them, of injuring them. Like, I know there was one monk, an elderly German monk, who was living in Sri Lanka. He was living in a cave, or he was came to stay in a cave. Then when he was in that cave, maybe a couple of days after he took up his residence there, a bear came into the cave, and the bear saw this monk living in the cave and thought, what is he doing taking over my house? And so the bear came after him, and this monk was very good in meditation, especially in metta meditation. And so what he did was to put his mind into the frame of the metta meditation, and then he started to recite the Metta Sutta, the Buddha's discourse on loving kindness. Then the bear, as the monk was chanting, stopped his forward movement, turned around, and walked out. But I think the monk changed his residence after that. He didn't stay in the cave. Okay, so when one fulfills this threefold training, then one is able to overcome this fear and dread. Okay, next comes the wish, may I become one to obtain at will, without trouble or difficulty, the four jhanas that constitute the higher mind and provide a pleasant abiding here and now. So to attain the jhanas, he has to fulfill, it said, the threefold training. So actually, to obtain the jhanas, one doesn't actually need the training in vipassana itself, since just the training in samadhi or in samatha is able to lead to the jhanas. But I think in order to keep the whole training intact, it's repeated with regard to each of these benefits. Okay, when we come to a later sutta, we'll go into the four jhanas themselves, but here we just take them as a group. Okay, so next comes a wish to reach the higher meditative stages beyond the jhanas. So if the monk should wish, may I contact with the body and abide in those liberations that are peaceful and immaterial or formless, transcending forms, let him fulfill this threefold training. And this passage is referring to the what are called the four formless meditative attainments. In Pali, these are called the arupa samapatti. Okay, so the four jhanas are sometimes called the four rupa samapatti. That means the four attainments with form, because they're based on some kind of, usually it's a visible form as the object, some kind of bright light, bright image. But beyond the four jhanas, there are four other meditative attainments which do not have any form as their object. These are refinements in the development of samadhi. You've come across these, I'm sure those who have read suttas extensively, you've come across these several times. They're called the base of the infinity of space, the base of the infinity of consciousness, the base of nothingness, the base of neither perception nor non-perception. We will encounter them again, and then I'll explain them when we come to them. But here it's sufficient just to know that the attainment of these states, these formless liberations, depends especially on fulfilling, observing the precepts and fulfilling the training in samadhi. And when they're called liberations, this has to be taken in a qualified sense. They're not liberations in the sense that they by themselves bring liberation from samsara, from birth and death, but rather they're called liberations because they liberate the mind temporarily from its connection to material form. And if one masters these formless meditations without developing wisdom, they will lead one to rebirth in the formless realms. There are realms of existence which correspond to the formless meditations. And so one who masters the formless meditations without developing insight or wisdom will tend to rebirth in the formless realms, which are very peaceful, very long-lasting. But from the Buddha's point of view, they are not in any way the ultimate goal. Okay, now starting with the next passage, the Buddha is going to show the stages of, we call these the stages of awakening, the stages of realization that can be achieved through the threefold training. In the last chapter, when we discussed the last chapter of In the Buddha's Words in my earlier course, we went through the four stages of realization. So here we can just take them concisely, not in detail. So the first stage is accomplished through the destruction of the three lower fetters. Actually, we met these already in the Savasava Sutta, which we took a few weeks ago. These are the three fetters of what's called identity view, or the view of a self existing in relation to the five aggregates, doubt, that is doubt about the Buddha and his teaching, and then silabhata paramasa, the wrong grasp of rules and observances. That's sort of blindly adhering to certain rules and observances with the idea that this is sufficient to attain liberation. And so with the achievement of the first stage of awakening, one penetrates the ultimate truth of the Dhamma. One sees the Four Noble Truths, and one cuts off those three fetters so that one enters the stream of the Dhamma, and one becomes what is called the Sotapanna, a stream enterer who's no longer subject to perdition. People don't use this word very often anymore. Maybe we would say who's no longer subject to rebirth in the lower realms. the stream enterer can no longer be reborn in the three lower realms, the hells, the animal realm, or the realm of the pretas, the tormented spirits. He's bound for liberation and heading for the full enlightenment. And then other texts say that this kind of disciple has no more than seven rebirths, either in the human realm or in the celestial realms, and then will make an end of dukkha, of birth and death. Okay, next, we now move on to the next, second stage of awakening. This is the stage of the once returner. And so, the once returner, like the stream enterer, has eradicated the first three fetters and has further weakened lust, hatred, and delusion. And so by weakening, further weakening lust, hatred, and delusion, this disciple, it said, returns once more to this world and then reaches the end of suffering. But if you remember the way I explained it in the last course, based on what the Abhidhamma and commentaries say, even though the sutta says he returns once more to this world, there's like a little footnote to that. He's either reborn once more in this world and reaches the end, or he's reborn in the heavenly realm and reaches the end there, or he's reborn in the heavenly realm, then comes down one more time to the human world, that's twice returning, and then makes an end. But probably because the usual way is one more rebirth, or at least that's the way for one with sharper faculties, so this disciple is called the once returner. Okay, then the third stage is one who destroys the five lower fetters, the five fetters that bind one to the sensuous realm of existence, even to the human realm, even to the heavenly realms in which there is still sensual enjoyment. And so this disciple eliminates, of course, the first three fetters. And on top of that, he eradicates sensual craving and ill will, anger, irritation. Those are the other two fetters that bind one to the sensual realm. And so one who eradicates the five lower fetters becomes a non-returner. In Pali, it's anagami. And this one, this kind of disciple, will still take rebirth, but not in the sensual realm. This kind of disciple will take rebirth in one of the higher realms of existence, in the form realm. They are reborn spontaneously, not with parents, and in the form realm, they attain final nibbana, full enlightenment, and they reach nirvana in that realm without ever taking rebirth again in the sense realm, sense sphere of existence. Now, normally, in the progression of stages of awakening, the stage of non-returner would be followed by the attainment of arhatship. But here, the text wants to put in all the benefits. And so, you see, the attainment of stream enterer, once returning, non-returning, let me put it this way. Sometimes the attainment of arhatship comes as the fourth of the four stages of awakening. But Other times, the attainment of arhatship comes as the sixth of what are called the six abhinya. These are the six higher knowledges, the six superior types of knowledge.
You've been talking, don't pull away from your post. It's okay.
Okay, so other times the text will present arhatship as the sixth of the six abhinya, the higher knowledges. So what this sutta has done is to splice the scheme of the six. It had to find a place to put in the five mundane abhinyas, culminating in arhatship as the sixth. And so what it did is to splice them in between the third stage of enlightenment and the fourth stage of enlightenment. And so we have six abhinyas. Five of these are worldly. That is, they don't require any kind of higher wisdom. But in the Buddha's day, even the yogis who are practicing meditation deep in the forest, without any kind of superior wisdom or enlightenment, just through the power of their samadhi, would be able to gain these supernormal powers. And even today, we sometimes hear about them, yogis in India who possess them, and meditators in some of the Buddhist countries. Maybe they will strike us as incredible, but it's said that these are powers that come through the strong development of meditation. And we meet them again and again in the Buddhist texts, and so for myself I have little doubt that they're attainable. Okay, so we have, first we have what are called the iddhis. These are the psychic powers, or sometimes called the magical powers, or mystical powers. So if the monk should wish, may I wield the various kinds of iddhis, supernormal powers, having been one, that's with one body, may I become many. So I'm able to emanate many bodies out from my original body, so that they all look alike. So maybe if you meet Bhikkhu Bodhi down in Taishu Hall, then you come up to Kuan Yin Hall in order to see the Buddha image here, then you see he's sitting in meditation there. So I left him just down below 5 minutes ago in Taishu Hall. How is he here? That's through the power of abhinya. But in my case, more likely somebody gave me a ride. Okay, then with the many bodies, one brings them all back into one's original body. Then one can appear, may I appear and vanish, that is, one can make oneself invisible, and then one can reappear wherever one wants. May I go unhindered through a wall, through an enclosure, through a mountain, as though through space, you know, without being obstructed. May I dive in and out of the earth as though it were water. So with the power of samadhi, one makes the determination, let the earth be like water for me. And then the earth, in one's own perception, becomes like water, and one can dive down into it. In other people might be watching you, and they see you go into the earth and come out, and they're amazed. But they don't know that this is through the power of samadhi that you've transformed that area of earth where you're standing effectively transformed it into water. May I walk on water without sinking as though it were earth. Through the power of the samadhi, one makes the determination, let this water be solid like earth, then one could walk across the water. Seated cross-legged, may I travel in space like a bird. This is something of which I can speak from direct personal experience. Sometimes when I'm flying in the plane, if there's nobody sitting next to me, then I might lift my legs up and cross them. But it's said that, you know, those who are really accomplished in meditation, they don't have to go to the airport to get on a plane, but they just can be sitting maybe in their cave, cross the legs, then make the determination, may I travel from this place to another place 100 miles away, and then the body will levitate even up hundreds of meters into space, and then they'll go traveling 100 miles away and then come descend. And then with my hand may I touch and stroke the moon and sun so powerful and mighty, and may I wield bodily mastery even as far as the Brahma world. The Brahma world is the beginning of the form realm. And so it said that the Buddha and some of the great disciples were able to go with their whole bodies intact to travel to other realms of existence, even up to the Brahma world, and to meet with the Brahma deities and to talk with them. You know, some people are skeptical of these things, but I always tell them that if we were living back, say, in the 15th century, 14th century, well, let me give you an example from my own experience. This doesn't go back to the 14th century, it goes back to 1984, 1985, when I was living in Sri Lanka. Then a friend of mine, a fellow American monk, told me that now in America there's this invention that you can be, you know, hundreds of miles, in fact, you know, you can be hundreds of miles away from another person, and you've written a letter, and you take this letter and you put it over this machine, you press a button, and another person hundreds of miles away will get that letter, a copy of that letter. If it's handwritten, it will be exactly in your handwriting. Everything just the way you've written it. And I said to him, come on, stop pulling my leg. You're just kidding me. And he said, no, they call this a fax machine. And like now the fax machine, it's, we all take it for granted. Now I remember the first time in Sri Lanka, 1987, I had to make a trip to India. And I went to the travel agent in the town of Kandy. And as often happens in Kandy, the telephones go out of service. So they tried to call maybe their headquarters in Colombo. Call wouldn't go through. Then the guy in the travel agent took this telephone and there was no wire to it. And I couldn't believe, he pressed some buttons and then he was talking on the telephone. And I was incredulous. How was he doing this? You know, this was the first time I ever saw a cell phone, 1987. Probably already in the US they were just fairly commonplace. But I don't think people in Sri Lanka yet, for the most part, had cell phones. They were just very rare, only a few more highly developed business offices would have them. Okay, now, like, every kid who gets to be 14 years old is asking, is it 14 or 13? Asking his parents, when am I going to get my handphone? When am I going to get my handphone? And then if they don't get the handphone, they're crying, oh, you have to give me the handphone. Okay, so this, even for me, 1985, 1987, I couldn't believe these things, but they turned out to be real. And then if you go back to the 14th century and you were to tell people then, oh, 5 centuries from now, people will be flying by in these metal devices from Europe to India. Of course, they didn't know India at that time, perhaps, but they'll be able to fly from England to France. Say, how is that possible? It seems unbelievable. So things that seem unbelievable to us, but let's say, yeah, we shouldn't doubt things that seem unbelievable to us just because they lie beyond our capability of comprehension, because they could be real to those who have those powers. Okay, so these are the supernormal powers. Then we come the divine ear element. This is the capacity of hearing sounds in distant realms of existence or in distant places in other realms of existence. The third is the ability to know the minds of others, to be able to read the thoughts of others, to know their mental states, to know the quality or level of their mind. You can read that in detail for yourself. The fourth is the ability to recollect one's previous lives, even going back hundreds and thousands of lives. The sixth is the divine eye with which one could see other beings passing away and taking rebirth in accordance with their karma. Okay, so these five are the mundane, called the mundane super knowledges, because they don't require any kind of superior wisdom, any kind of deep insight into the nature of things, but just the ability to use the power of samadhi to develop certain faculties normally lying latent in the mind, which can now awaken through the mastery of the mind achieved by samadhi. But the sixth abhinya is the fourth stage of enlightenment, and this is the destruction of the asavas, the outflows, the influxes, the leakages or taints. And so here the monk might wish, may I, by realizing for myself with direct knowledge, here and now enter upon and abide in the deliverance of mind, the liberation of mind, and liberation by wisdom that are taintless with the destruction of the taints, the destruction of the asavas. So in other words, this is the wish to achieve the complete destruction of all of the mind's defilements. And thereby one gains what is called the liberation of mind, which is at the same time a liberation by wisdom. Wisdom cuts off all the defilements, and then one can enter into this liberation of mind, which is completely free from any kind of contaminating influence of the defilements. So if one has such a wish, again, the requisites are the same. Let him fulfill the precepts, be devoted to inner serenity, of internal serenity of mind, not neglecting meditation. Let one be possessed of insight, and let one frequently dwell in empty huts. And then the sutta closes by repeating the opening paragraph, again underscoring the importance for the monastics of possessing this virtue or restraint of the patimokkha. Okay, so this will be our presentation of the sutta. If there's any questions on any of this, then please feel welcome to. We could take some questions now. Okay, Richard?
Thank you.
Yeah, okay. Is it on? Yeah, it's on.
This last section 19, is there anything to be made out of to understand about this? When they refer to the structure of the taints as the plan of liberation rather than the uprooting of the other five fetters. Progression.
This is an interesting point. I found that the other five, what's called the higher fetters, are not mentioned very often. And I know some have introduced the idea that the five higher fetters were not an original part of the Buddha's teaching. This I don't know. One does find them in the Samyutta Nikaya, in the fifth book of the Samyutta Nikaya, in a repetitive passage, where it's like part of a standard formula applied to all of the different factors of the path, the Noble Eightfold Path, the seven enlightenment factors, the four foundations of mindfulness, and so on. All of those are said to be the way to eliminate the five higher fetters. But usually one doesn't get, in the Majjhima Nikaya, I'm not sure that the five higher fetters are mentioned at all. So instead of bringing in the five higher fetters, these texts usually bring in the destruction of the asavas. So I don't know the explanation for that, but of the five fetters, three of them are comprised within the destruction of the asavas. Did everybody get the sheet which correlates asavas with asavas with fetters and latent tendencies? No. Anyway, I will bring it next time. I have to make some more copies, I think. If you didn't get a copy, then raise the hand so I'll get some idea how many. Oh, you were absent last time. Yeah, so about 10. Yeah, I can make about 12 more copies.
So even though there's an implicit reference to the being other fetters, it says the five, here we see the five lower fetters.
Yeah.
But it's not explicitly discussed in the...
Yeah, one doesn't meet the five higher fetters, often contrasted with the five lower fetters. Just the five lower fetters are mentioned, and then what lies beyond the elimination of the five lower fetters is the destruction of the asavas. Oh, these are copies that were left from last week. Oh, okay. Let's see how many we have here. Maybe I'll just put it here, and then I think there's about six to eight copies. But then I'll bring more copies next time. Did everybody get a copy now? Anybody didn't get a copy? Okay, I'll bring some copies next time. Don't worry, you'll get it. any further questions?
Okay, do you have suggestions on practical steps to overcome the identity view?
Well, to overcome the identity view, one has to develop the insight into non-self, and then one has to do that by going through the stages of... One has to develop some degree of samadhi. In my view, it doesn't have to be developed to the level of jhana in order to practice insight. And then one would have to go through the procedure for practicing insight meditation, which is basically practicing the four satipatthanas. And normally, the insight into impermanence, emerges first, then one could use that either directly to see into non-self, or one could go from impermanence to dukkha and then use both of them to see into non-self.
You talked about you said that in the text that jhana is used sometimes in a more general sense to indicate activity of meditation rather than the absorption type of meditation. Is that, I don't want to take your words too far, so I'm wondering if that also means that when we simply meditate, by that I mean shamatha and vipassana meditation. Is that also understood to mean that the shamatha and vipassana meditation lead to those absorptions?
Lead to
the absorption to jhana. Without a specific activity of jhana meditation.
Okay, this is an interesting question. First, it would be the practices of samatha that are designed to lead to the jhanas, rather than the practice of vipassana. Though it needs a certain amount of, I would say, wisdom or insight into the workings of the mind in order to know what kind of mental factors have arisen, which are wholesome, which are unwholesome, how one has to apply, say, balance one's energy and calmness in order to achieve the jhanas. Now there are certain meditation subjects which are said to be more conducive to the jhanas than others. And so, for example, it's the mindfulness of breathing, which is recommended as a meditation that leads to the jhanas. And this is said to be the meditation subject the Buddha himself used on the night of his enlightenment. And then, particularly within the tradition stemming from the Visuddhimagga, there's a kind of device mentioned in the suttas called kasina, which you must have heard of. They're like circular discs, sometimes representing one of the four elements, or sometimes covered with a particular color, like all blue, all white, all red, all yellow. And so that kind of meditation is especially conducive to jhana. A meditation subject like analysis of the body into the four elements, or say the mindful observance of the arising and passing of phenomena, does not lead to the four jhanas themselves. But the commentaries sometimes try to give a broader meaning to the word jhana than one finds in the suttas. So they speak about that jhana means the focusing of the mind, the intense focusing of the mind on an object. And so the suttas say that, or the commentaries say that there is, I forgot the exact terms of distinction, but the distinction is between the jhanas which are achieved through samatha meditation, and those are actually the four jhanas of the suttas. And then there is the intense contemplation of an object which brings insight knowledge, and that is the intense focusing of the mind on the three characteristics, anicca, dukkha, anatta. Okay, I'm going to look at the questions that come from the internet. Then we'll have to stop for the morning and then come back after lunch for about a half an hour discussion period. Okay, question one, is the phrase dwelling in empty huts very similar to the phrase for the days abiding that we find in many suttas? Yeah, it's similar. For the days abiding just means that one finds a suitable place to dwell for the day. It might not be in a hut, it could be at the foot of a tree or in the forest, but the empty hut is a better sheltered place. Question two, So the accomplished yogi, does the expression "the day's abiding" mean that they enter the jhana states and become detached from the six senses of worldly experience? Probably for accomplished yogis, that's what it means. But it doesn't necessarily have that meaning. Somebody who's not an accomplished yogi can still go into a quiet, secluded place for the day's dwelling without being able to enter the jhana. But they'll practice for the achievement either of jhana or for insight. Okay, meditation teachers stress that for successful meditation, the mind should not have any expectations or desires such as the desire for jhana. Isn't it a paradox that the Buddhist aspirants must have wishes? It's not as much of a paradox as it might sound, since if one wishes to achieve the jhana, what one does is form the aspiration or wish, then one undertakes the practice. But when one is engaged in the practice, in order to gain that kind of stillness or balance of mind needed to enter the jhana, one shouldn't be constantly hankering after the jhana, as though it's a kind of state that one wants to enter through one's craving for this superior experience, but with the idea, I want to gain the jhana so I could come out and then tell all my friends who are still struggling with wandering thoughts, sensual desire, angry thoughts. Then they'll say, how was your meditation today? Oh, I just got to the second jhana. I wasn't able to get into the third. Then they'll say, wow, he's really beyond us. Yeah, so one can form that aspiration, then one practices, but one doesn't let the mind get carried away by this, I gotta get the jhana, I gotta get it. Because that will be a disturbance. If a person has jhana experience beforehand, if they switch to vipassana meditation, is it possible for him to reach vipassana jhana status? Normally, using the sutta terminology, we don't speak about vipassana jhana, though I think Upandita uses that expression, vipassana jhana. But what he actually means are the stages of vipassana knowledge which are held to be counterparts in some way of the jhanas. Okay, so if one has strong jhana experience, and that will provide a firm foundation for developing the vipassana meditation. Though some people who are very skilled in jhana have a difficult time with vipassana, where others who are not so skilled in jhana will move more easily into vipassana. So normally, jhana will provide a solid foundation for vipassana, but a lot depends upon the individual faculties and dispositions of the individual meditator. Okay, with this we'll have to close the discussion for the morning, but those of you who want to participate in the discussion period can come back about 12 o'clock and then we could take some more questions. Okay, so we end with the sharing of the merits. Again, this is, as I explained earlier, to share the merits that we've acquired through practicing the meditation earlier, explaining the Dhamma, discussing the Dhamma. We share it with the other beings in the other realms, inviting them to rejoice, to gain the merits for themselves thereby, and then to protect ourselves, others, and the world. Okay, so I recite in Pali. If you wish to join, you can join in.
Akasata chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumodiva chirang rakantu sasana. Akasata chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumodiva chirang rakantu desana. Akasa ta jabuma ta deva naga mahitika punyantang anumodipa chirang rakantu mang parang eta vatacha mehi sampadang punya sampadang. I'll do it a short way. Sabbe devanumodantu, sabbe bhutanumodantu, sabbe satanumodantu, sabba sampati siddhya, babagupadhaya vichihetato, he tantare satakayupapanna, rupi arupicha asanya sanyino. Dukkha pamuchantu pusantu nibbutin.
Okay, so next week we'll have a class, and the next class will be on sutta number 7 from the Majjhima Nikaya. This is the simile of the cloth. I think it's already on the Baus website, and I'll also give Kaiti the next suttas that we'll take so she could put them up on the website. After that, we do 21st next week. 28th, there's no class. December 5th, I think it is,
yes,
we'll have the class. I'll try to do the whole of Majjhima 7 next week, and then December 5th, Majjhima number 8. And both of them are very useful suttas for personal mind training. Okay, we end with the three bows. Three half bows.